From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Philosophy and Culture in Post-Victorian England, this week on Soundings. My guest is Tom Reagan of North Carolina State University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Tom Reagan completed Bloomsbury's Prophet, The Moral Philosophy of G.E. Moore, published by Temple University Press. Tom Reagan is also the editor of G.E. Moore, The Early Essays. Let's begin with this. Why is Moore Bloomsbury's prophet? Why did you pick that kind of a title?
In fact, if you look at Moore's autobiographical sketch, which he publishes in 1945, looking back on his life, he mentions any number of important philosophers with whom he was associated. He mentions Russell and Wittgenstein and Sidgwick and MacTaggart and Broad, a number of other important philosophers. What's significant is that nowhere does he mention John Maynard Keynes or Virginia Woolf or Vanessa Bell or Duncan Grant or Desmond McCarthy, his closest and dearest friend of his throughout his life. None of the Bloomsburys mentioned at all. And so part of the reason that there is something of a paradox here about Moore's connection with Bloomsbury, or something of a mystery, I guess would be a better way of putting it, is that he himself did nothing to divulge the connection. Mm-hmm. When he had the opportunity to say, and in reminiscing, and there were these people I knew and had some association with, he chose not to do so.
And yet you call him Bloomsbury's prophet.
That's correct.
And we have this wonderful disparity, but not only in terms of personalities, but I imagine in terms of ideas as well.
That's right. And the key to it, actually, for me, was to gain access to a good bit of unpublished material, including correspondence. But certainly part of the key was this, that Moore belonged to a semi-secret group at Cambridge called the Apostles. Hmm. And subsequently, in later years, a number of the core of Bloomsbury became members of the Apostles. Keynes was a member, Lytton Strachey was a member, Desmond McCarthy was a member. So there was this Cambridge core of Bloomsbury that came through the Apostles. Now, the Apostles was a group of the most brilliant intellectuals that happened to come to Cambridge.
Mm-hmm. Self-selected, I take it?
Self-selected, 12 in number, hence the name, the Apostles, meeting in secret. And what they would do is every Saturday they would meet during term and somebody would read a paper. And then they would debate it, and then they would take a vote on it to see which side was had won out in the debate. But again, you can imagine Russell and MacTaggart and Moore and Wittgenstein and Keynes, these really tremendously brilliant people gathering and debating ideas.
This was the prototype for the National Humanities Center.
That's right. Except having been here for a while, I can say that probably the level of discussion at Cambridge may have been a little bit more severe. But what we find then is that Moore wrote some 20 papers during this period of time when he belonged to the Apostles. He also did not publish a number of papers on popular topics like religion. Mm-hmm. He belonged to a group called the Sunday Essay Society. He gave a set of lectures in London, which again were never published. Just a good bit of unpublished material. Now, when one reads this unpublished material, one begins to see a quite different person than the person that Moore reveals in his published work. Mm-hmm. The person he reveals in his published work is one who is at great pains to make ideas enormously clear and enormously boring at the same time.
Oh boy!
So he'll spend. I imagine him in the book, in fact, worrying himself to near exhaustion over the meaning of the word could, as in saying he could have acted otherwise. What does the word could mean?
Now, the philosophers love words like could and should and ought. And,
well, the philosophers love words generally, and part of what Moore's influence has been in the 20th century was he was often looked upon as something of the patron saint of so-called ordinary language philosophy, the attempt to really get unclear about ideas like could and know and believe and so on. So again, part of the reason that we find it incongruous to think about Moore as Bloomsbury's prophet is because there was this public Moore that Moore himself helped create, and that Moore himself helped sustain, not only by what he said or didn't say in his autobiography, but also by what he collected and what he didn't collect his published work.
Which of the two, Tom Regan, the public or the private G.E. Moores, which of the two is more important? I imagine you're going to tell me that they're both important, that you have to take them both into account. But again, we're getting at the motive for your having written this book, for calling him Bloomsbury's prophet.
Well, I think actually the Bloomsbury Moore is the more interesting of the two, and possibly historically more important than the erudite philosopher that we've come to know.
Now, is this the man who defends common sense?
This is one and the same. In fact, Moore made himself very famous in his lifetime as the defender of common sense, and I think he was perfectly genuine about this. He says in his autobiography that the world never suggested a single philosophical question to him. He was perfectly happy to look at the world and take it for what it was. What occasioned great philosophical perplexity and more, as he says, is what philosophers said about the world. And he just couldn't.
There's nothing new in that.
So that when philosophers said that time was unreal, or when they said that you could never know anything about the past, or that wasn't sure that there was a chair beside the table or any of these things, he found these enormously perplexing. So he stood up for common sense, but he also said that there was a tremendous difference between simply saying, I don't believe any of this stuff, I believe what ordinary men and women believe, and quite a different thing between the philosopher to try to say what it is that you believe when you believe these things, when you believe that there is a table beside the chair beside the table, when you believe that yesterday was Tuesday, when you believe all these things. It's very difficult to understand these ideas. So there was enough for a philosopher to do, he thought. But again, this is the public Moore. Now, the private Moore, the one that we see in the unpublished work, and the one who is between the lines in the most important book that Moore writes, which is in the 1903 book, Principia Ethica. That private Moore is a man who is very much a product of his time. He had, as was so characteristic of late Victorian educated English men, he was in the process of and had fairly much abandoned belief in God. He was coming into the 20th century. But at the same time, he had no creed or credo to put in the place of this abandoned set of beliefs. And it was a nervous time, one might say, an unsettled time for not only Moore, but also for many of his peers. What do you put in the place of an abandoned religious faith?
What did he put there?
Well, this is the story that I try to tell in the book, because what he made it as difficult as he could for himself without intending to do so. The one thing he would not do intentionally was to abdicate respect for reason. He wanted to be as rational as he could be.
He says somewhere that what is really or more completely beautiful is completely rational.
That's right. Uh-huh. The more beautiful is the more rational, right? And so what he was struggling to do was to, he thought there was no good reason to believe in the creed of his parents.
Which was what, conventional Christianity,
right. Uh-huh. At the same time, what he respected was reason. Now the challenge is, what do you put in place of that has the power or performs the function of a religious belief and, mm-hmm. and the function that a traditional, conventional religious belief performs is to give one some sense of the importance of one's life, mm-hmm. some sense of a reason for being, something to live for. So let me try to put it in context of his most important book again, Principia Ethica. What Moore is known for in philosophy is, in addition to being the defender of common sense, is the discoverer of what's called the naturalistic fallacy.
And what does that mean?
Well, would that anyone knew precisely what that means, but it means something like this, I think. Moore seems to have thought that there are certain value, ideas of value, things that concerning in particular, what things really are worthwhile simply for their own sakes. There are certain, those ideas, that very idea of something being worthwhile for its own sake, he thought you simply couldn't exchange that idea for any other idea. In other words, you couldn't take that idea, something really worthwhile for its own sake, and say, well, that's the same as pleasure, mm-hmm. or that's the same as knowledge, or that's the same as beauty.
But are we talking about a hierarchy here of sort of transcendental values? I don't necessarily mean mm-hmm. supernatural, but things that are beyond us as human beings.
They're beyond us in this sense, and this is very important to Moore's program. They're beyond us in the sense that they cannot be reduced. Our knowledge of them cannot be reduced to our knowledge of any other kind of thing. So that, for example, if we could reduce the idea, what he calls good, but which he means by something worth having simply for its own sake, mm-hmm. if we could reduce that notion of intrinsic goodness to the satisfaction of preference, for example, then in principle we could study what is valuable by doing psychology, because we could simply do a certain psychological test and find out what people prefer.
Mm-hmm. And then we could call that good.
Mm-hmm. Or if we could reduce the idea of intrinsic goodness to something in biology, for example, something that acts to perpetuate anything that serves to perpetuate the species, for example. Suppose we define good that way, mm-hmm. then theoretically we could discover what things are good by doing biology.
He's ahistorical. He isn't necessarily looking for precedence. He's not looking for what comes before humankind or after, right. but just bingo, what's right. right here.
Right. So right. And so the crucial thing is, see, if he's successful in this part of his program, then what happens is that there is no science, either natural or behavioral or life or philosophical or theological, there is no science that can answer this question that I have. What is good? Mm-hmm. No science can answer that question, including, and this is what people have missed consistently in trying to see the great service that Moore performs for his peers, including ethics itself, the science that he practices as a moral philosopher. He, throughout his Principia Ethica, the Principles of Ethics, throughout that book, he always talks about ethics as a science. And when he tries to show that there is no scientific answer to this question, he means to include the very science that he himself is practicing. Now, imagine that you're a Victorian, late Victorian, see, and there are any number of ways in which you would have thought that these questions of fundamental value could have been answered. God could have told you them through the conventional traditions, Christian's traditions, or Spencer and Darwin and the biologists, evolutionary biologists, mm-hmm. knew what things were good and so on. Moore says no to all that. Now, what that does for some people, of course, is it sends them into shock and despair, because they think, oh my goodness, now I've got to try to decide these things all by myself, and it's lonely and mm-hmm. and tough. But for other sorts of people, it's just the news they want, see, because they never thought that anyone else knew very much about anything anyhow.
And so despite the superficial disparities, this is you're telling me here is a direct link, a way in which Moore would find himself comfortable with all of these bizarre characters
in the
Bloomsbury group.
That's right, because see, Moore, now you begin to see, well, Moore has has this hidden Promethean character about him. He's somebody who can steal a little bit of fire from the gods, and the fire he steals from the gods is the fire of tradition, the fire of reverence for science, not just reverence for God, mind you, but I mean reverence. See, what would be more natural than to think when the gods dead, we'll put science in God's place? But that's exactly what he's trying to show you can't do. The questions are fundamental questions of the meaning of life, just have to be faced bravely, courageously, on your own. Mm-hmm. So there's that part of him. But then the other things that are interesting. See, once all this is, for the most part, well known about Moore, namely that he argued that good's indefinable and that there's this thing called the naturalistic fallacy. But it's usually taught in this very arid and dry atmosphere and no connection between who he was and when he was and where he was and so on. Mm-hmm. But as important as all that is to understanding his book and his thought and his influence on Bloomsbury, it ends up that this is really the preliminary to the main event, someplace else.
That being
the fifth chapter of Principia. And this is a chapter, I swear, this is true, that there are probably only four philosophers in the world who have ever read this chapter, because the way Moore is usually read is you read the earlier chapters in Principia where he argues about the indefinability of good, all the stuff about the naturalistic fallacy, and you forget completely about chapter 5. That's called Ethics in Relation to Conduct. Uh-huh. Everybody thinks this is up till now, I think everybody's ignored this chapter and regarded it as merely a feeble defense of conventional morality. Where they say, well, all that Moore does in this chapter is to say that when you don't know what you ought to do, follow the rules of society. So they thought it was very conventional.
Well, now don't tell me that he's going to cave in here and eventually end up being what, if not conservative at the end of his life, very, very conventional. Is that what happened?
No, in fact, I had thought something like this was true because this is the way I'd been trained and this is the way I'd read Principia and this is the way I interpreted Moore. So what happened in my case was that I read a letter that Linton Strachey had written to John Maynard Keynes after Principia was published.
These were two eminent, well, not Victorians, but eminent Edwardians.
Very much, very eminent. And what Strachey says in the letter is, he says, the last two chapters, glory, hallelujah. And now, the last chapter is the chapter on the ideal, which I have something to say about momentarily, but the next to the last chapter, and which is included in Strachey's, the compass of what Strachey says, is the chapter 5, Ethics in Relation to Conduct. And it occurred to me while I was working on this then that if Strachey found something in that chapter to shout glory hallelujah about, then there must be something in there, because Strachey was no fool. Mm-hmm. There must be more in there than meets the eye, more than I'd been taught, more than everybody had found. So I read that chapter again with glory hallelujah in front of me all the time. And you know, Strachey's right. There is something just enormously powerful and interesting about that chapter.
Well, don't keep us in suspense.
What Moore argues is this, that if you try, what makes an act right, he says, is are the consequences of that act. And so now, in other words, there isn't anything in his view that's right or wrong in and of itself. If robbery is wrong and arson is wrong and being unkind to cats and dogs is wrong, then it's wrong because of the consequences or the effects or the results of that kind of behavior. In fact, he even says that right is to be defined as cause of good results. Now, the question then is, when we try to find out what things are right and what things are wrong, we have to find out what the consequences of things are. And what Moore argues with great skill and great passion is that, limited as we are, we can never really know what the total consequences of any of our acts are. And in fact, when it comes to really knowing right from wrong, we have to kind of just say that we draw a blank.
Is this philosophical buck passing? Do I detect a sort of well, I'm not responsible. I'll just let the pebble drop and watch the concentric circles. That sounds pretty weak coming from somebody.
Yeah, well, he's.
I don't mean you, but I mean that sound in defense of Moore.
Right. So now what he says is, well, you know, what we could do is, since we don't know all that, what's the next best thing we could do? And he said, well, we might just think about what would be the consequences of our acts, not over all time, but in the immediate future, for heaven's sake, you know, the next few hours or a few weeks or something, anyhow, at the most.
To create a sense of responsibility.
Create a sense of responsibility, yeah. And he said, but, you know, even then, we really don't know very much about what the consequences are going to be, especially when we're dealing with people we don't know very well. You know, when we're dealing with the world outside of the people we know, and I mean, we're really kind of stepping off a cliff there. Well, what could we do to try to make sure that we're making the world as good as we can then, given the uncertainty of our knowledge, especially when we start thinking in terms of the long-term future and when we start thinking about our effects on people we don't know well and so on. And he argues, well, the thing to do then, here's the way you do best, and that is to locate yourself around some friends you've got who share the interest you've got, and act in a sensitive, caring way with them, with your friends and your family members, and that's the best sort of life you can have, because this is the way you can have the most confidence that what you're doing will bring about the best results, given our ignorance about the long-term future and results, and given the uncertainty when you introduce new people and so on. So that what this does is it encourages people.
We're back to community.
We're back to the Bloomsbury Group, you see, because what the Bloomsbury Group was nothing except, if not, Moore's ethics in relation to conduct writ in a very public sort of way, because they gathered together, they had shared similar interests. The larger world of politics and social reform and other kinds of social issues, for the most part, they had no interest in that. Not unanimously, but for the most part, this was characteristic of them. And if you said, well, why? I mean, shouldn't you be out trying to change the world rather than to enjoy yourself here gathered amongst your friends doing the things that Bloomsbury's do? They had a very good response to that, and that was that Moore had taught them that was not what they should be doing.
Well, now, don't we have a bit of a paradox? I mean, we have many, many paradoxes running through the subject of this conversation, Tom Regan, G.E. Moore, the philosopher. Isn't there a paradox in the sense that we look back, at least the cultural historians look back at the Bloomsbury's, and they say, wow, what enormously influential people.
Oh, yes, very
much
so.
How do we determine that?
Yeah, very much so. And in fact, one of the things that I argue is that when you look at Moore's life then, you see that Moore practiced exactly what he preached.
Mm-hmm.
And again,
so you can give him that.
That's right. What he preached, remember, was not to tend one's own garden, if you like, to be a prudent, temperate man, that didn't suppose you could change society by the force of your will and so on. To just tend your own garden and to make the best use of your own skills amongst friends.
And hope that that social reform, whatever that is,
yes,
that very large, lovely concept,
yes,
sort of flows from that somehow.
That's right. It's very much of the notion of the invisible hand that you get in some thinkers. I mean, how do you make the world better? Mm-hmm. Well, many people think, well, we've got to change the structure of society.
You begin by changing your own structure.
That's right. Moore's position was that seems almost destined to failure.
Uh-huh.
The way you can make the world better is to work at perfecting your own talents, and especially sharing them with friends that share similar interests.
Uh-huh. Tom Regan, you called your book about G.E. Moore, Bloomsbury's Prophet. Is Moore anybody's prophet today? Does he count mainly for, I'll be impertinent and say, why another book about a dusty academic philosopher? Does he matter to anybody beyond the sort of philosophical circles that you move in?
I think so. I think that there are in two different ways. One, certainly, in terms of the history of ideas, I think that this different Moore is going to have to be taken into account by anyone doing intellectual history in the 20th century because of what I think is his influence on other people who certainly have had influence, from Keynes to Virginia Woolf on down. So, in that respect, it will be of interest to people other than philosophers. One of the things I like about the book, in fact, is that people who read it say it's fun to read. And
that's it is indeed. What you've done here is a sort of cultural history.
That's right.
And you say that you're seeking, you know, a sort of philosophical rigor or integrity at the same time, but it is not dusty.
Well, I hope not. And in fact, it was a fun book to write. And if it is at all fun, that makes it unusual for dusty philosophy that by itself. So I hope it is fun to read. But then the other thing is that I think that Moore probably has more relevance than to the contemporary scene that read through Bloomsbury's eyes than he does read through standard conventional eyes, the standard conventional interpretation of his views. There we see him only again as a dusty academic worrying about what the meaning of could or good or whatever is. Now we see him through Bloomsbury's eyes as he emerges in my study of him, anyhow, as a man who's struggling with the human struggle to make sense out of one's own life. Mm-hmm. And giving up on religion, giving up on science, giving up on all the expert answers to this question, and realizing when it comes to questions of this depth and this magnitude, there are no experts, that everyone has to wrestle with this question individually. In that sense, he's a very contemporary figure now, see? And in that sense, I think there is something in his life with which all of us can identify. Uh-huh. And so in this respect, he truly is, as I want to present him as, this Promethean figure liberating others, even if it means being chained to his desk and having the birds come and eat the word could out of his liver every day or something, you know. I mean, whatever the image one wants. Yeah. But in any event, it's not as though having liberated himself, what he did was he presented a systematic defense of the kind of life he wanted to live. And the kind of life he wanted to live was that of a dusty academic. But he wanted to say, what made that a worthwhile life? And he was able to try to do that, I think. Other people reading the same book were encouraged to go down different paths, and they did so.
Tom Regan teaches at North Carolina State University. Tom Regan is the author of Bloomsbury's Prophet, The Moral Philosophy of G.E. Moore, and the editor of G.E. Moore, The Early Essays, both published by Temple University Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Philosophy and Culture in Post-Victorian England, send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 401. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about fashion and fashionability in 19th century French culture. My guest will be Seema Godfrey of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Partial support for Soundings comes from The Leader, News of the Research Triangle. Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Philosophy and Culture in Post-Victorian England, this week on Soundings. Listen for a discussion featuring Tom Regan of North Carolina State University. Tom Regan is the author of Bloomsbury's Prophet, The Moral Philosophy of G.E. Moore, and the editor of G.E. Moore, The Early Essays. Bloomsbury's Prophet, some answers and insights this week on Soundings.